Chapter 83, Draupadi Meets the Queens of Krishna. Shukadev Goswami said, "Thus Lord Krishna, the spiritual master of the gopis and the very purpose of their life, showed them his mercy. He then met with Yudhisthira and all his other relatives and inquired from them about their welfare. Feeling greatly honored, King Yudhisthira and the others, freed of all sinful reactions by seeing the feet of the Lord of the universe, gladly answered his inquiries. Lord Krishna's relative said, 'O Master, how can misfortune arise for those who have even once freely drunk the nectar coming from your lotus feet? This intoxicating liquor pours into the drinking cups of their ears, having flowed from the minds of great devotees through their mouths. It destroys the embodied soul's forgetfulness of the creator of their bodily existence. The radiance of your personal form dispels the threefold effects of material consciousness, and by your grace we become immersed in total happiness. Your knowledge is indivisible and unrestricted. By your yogamaya potency you have assumed this human form for protecting the Vedas, which had been threatened by time. We bow down to you, the final destination of perfect saints.'" Shukadev Goswami said, "As Yudhisthira and the others were thus praising Lord Krishna, the crest jewel of all sublimely glorified personalities, the women of the Undaka and Kaurava clans met with one another and began discussing topics about Govinda that are sung throughout the three worlds. Please listen as I relate these to you." Sri Draupadi said, "O Vaidarbhi, Bhadra, and Jambavati, O Kaushala, Satyabhama, and Kalindi, O Shaibya, Rohini, Lakshmana, and other wives of Lord Krishna, please tell me how the Supreme Lord Achyuta, imitating the ways of this world by his mystic power, came to marry each of you." Sri Rukmini said, "When all the kings held their bows at the ready to assure that I would be presented to Shishupal, he who puts the dust of his feet on the heads of invincible warriors took me from their midst, as a lion forcibly takes his prey from the midst of goats and sheep. May I always be allowed to worship those feet of Lord Krishna, the abode of Goddess Sri." Sri Satyabhama said, "My father, his heart tormented by my brother's murder, blamed Lord Krishna for the crime. To remove the stain on his reputation, the Lord defeated the king of the bears and took back the Syamantaka jewel, which he then returned to my father. Fearing the consequences of his offense, my father offered me to the Lord, even though I had already been promised to others." Sri Jambavati said, "Unaware that Lord Krishna was none other than his own master and worshipable deity, the husband of Goddess Sita, my father fought with him for 27 days. When my father finally came to his senses and recognized the Lord, he took hold of his feet and presented him with both me and the Syamantaka jewel as tokens of his reverence. I am simply the Lord's maidservant." Sri Kalindi said, "The Lord knew I was performing severe austerities and penances with the hope of one day touching his lotus feet. So he came to me in the company of his friend and took my hand in marriage. Now I am engaged as a sweeper in his palace." Sri Mitravinda said, "At my Swayamvara ceremony, he came forward, defeated all the kings present, including my brothers who dared insult him, and took me away just as a lion removes his prey from amidst a pack of dogs. Thus Lord Krishna, the shelter of the Goddess of Fortune, brought me to his capital city. May I be allowed to serve him by washing his feet, life after life." Sri Satya said, "My father arranged for 7 extremely powerful and vigorous bulls with deadly sharp horns to test the prowess of the kings who desired my hand in marriage. Although these bulls destroyed the false pride of many heroes, Lord Krishna subdued them effortlessly, tying them up in the same way that children playfully tie up a goat's kids. He thus purchased me with his valor. Then he took me away with my maidservants and a full army of 4 divisions, defeating all the kings who opposed him along the road. May I be granted the privilege of serving that Lord." Sri Bhadra said, "My dear Draupadi, of his own free will, my father invited his nephew Krishna, to whom I had already dedicated my heart, and offered me to him as his bride. My father presented me to the Lord with an Akshauhini military guard and a retinue of my female companions. My ultimate perfection is this, to always be allowed to touch Lord Krishna's lotus feet as I wander from life to life, bound by my karma." Sri Lakshmana said, "O Queen, I repeatedly heard Narada Muni glorify the appearances and activities of Achyuta, and thus my heart also became attached to that Lord Mukunda. Indeed, even the goddess of fortune chose him as her husband after careful consideration, rejecting the great demigods who rule various planets. My father, Brihatsen, was by nature compassionate to his daughter, and knowing how I felt, O saintly lady, he arranged to fulfill my desire. Just as a fish was used as a target in your Swayamvara ceremony to assure that you would obtain Arjun as your husband, so a fish was also used in my ceremony. In my case, however, it was concealed on all sides, and only its reflection could be seen in a pot of water below. Hearing of this, thousands of kings expert in shooting arrows and in wielding other weapons converged from all directions on my father's city, accompanied by their military teachers. My father properly honored each king according to his strength and seniority. Then those whose minds were fixed on me took up the bow and arrow and one by one tried to pierce the target in the midst of the assembly. Some of them picked up the bow but could not string it, and so they threw it aside in frustration. Some managed to pull the bowstring toward the tip of the bow, only to have the bow spring back and knock them to the ground. A few heroes, namely Jarasandha, Shishupal, Bhima, Duryodhana, Karna, and the king of Ambasta, succeeded in stringing the bow, but none of them could find the target. Then Arjun looked at the reflection of the fish in the water and determined its position. When he carefully shot his arrow at it, however, he did not pierce the target, but merely grazed it. After all the arrogant kings had given up, their pride broken, the Supreme Personality of Godhead picked up the bow, easily strung it, and then fixed his arrow upon it. As the sun stood in the constellation Abhijit, he looked at the fish in the water only once, and then pierced it with the arrow, knocking it to the ground. Kettledrums resounded in the sky, and on the earth people shouted, "Jai! Jai!" Overjoyed, demigods showered flowers. Just then I walked onto the ceremonial ground, the ankle bells on my feet gently tinkling. I was wearing new garments of the finest silk tied with a belt, and I carried a brilliant necklace fashioned of gold and jewels. There was a shy smile on my face and a wreath of flowers in my hair. I lifted my face, which was encircled by my abundant locks and effulgent from the glow of my earrings reflected from my cheeks. Smiling coolly, I glanced about. Then, looking around at all the kings, I slowly placed the necklace on the shoulder of Murari, who had captured my heart. Just then there were loud sounds of conch shells and mridanga, pataha, beri, and anaka drums, as well as other instruments. Men and women began to dance, and singers began to sing. The leading kings there could not tolerate my having chosen the Supreme Personality of Godhead, O Draupadi. Burning with lust, they became quarrelsome. The Lord then placed me on his chariot, drawn by four most excellent horses. Donning his armor and readying his bow shanga, he stood on the chariot, and there on the battleground he manifested his four arms. Daruka drove the Lord's gold-trimmed chariot as the kings looked on, O queen, like small animals helplessly watching a lion. The kings pursued the Lord like village dogs chasing a lion. Some kings, raising their bows, stationed themselves on the road to stop him as he passed by. These warriors were deluged by arrows shot from the Lord's bow, Shanga. Some of the kings fell on the battlefield with severed arms, legs, and necks. The rest gave up the fight and fled. The Lord of the Yadus then entered his capital city, Dwaraka, which is glorified in heaven and on earth. The city was elaborately decorated with flagpoles carrying banners that blocked the sun, and also with splendid archways. As Lord Krishna entered, he appeared like the sun god entering his abode. My father honored his friends, family, and in-laws with priceless clothing and jewelry, and with royal beds, thrones, and other furnishings. With devotion, he presented the perfectly complete Lord with a number of maidservants bedecked with precious ornaments. Accompanying these maidservants were guards walking on foot and others riding elephants, chariots, and horses. He also gave the Lord extremely valuable weapons. Thus, by renouncing all material association and practicing austere penances, we queens have all become personal maidservants of the self-satisfied Supreme Lord. Rohini Devi, speaking for the other queens, said, "After killing Bhaumasura and his followers, The Lord found us in the demon's prison and could understand that we were the daughters of the kings whom Bhoma had defeated during his conquest of the earth. The Lord set us free, and because we had been constantly meditating upon his lotus feet, the source of liberation from material entanglement, he agreed to marry us, though his every desire is already fulfilled. O saintly lady, we do not desire dominion over the earth, the sovereignty of the King of Heaven, unlimited facility for enjoyment, mystic power, the position of Lord Brahma, immortality, or even attainment of the kingdom of God. We simply desire to carry on our heads the glorious dust of Lord Krishna's feet, enriched by the fragrance of kumkum from his consort's bosom. We desire the same contact with the Supreme Lord's feet that the young women of Braja, the coward boys, and even the aborigine Pulinda women desire, the touch of the dust he leaves on the plants and grass as he tends his cows. Chapter 84, The Sage's Teachings at Kurukshetra. Shukadev Goswami said, Prita, Gandhari, Draupadi, Subhadra, the wives of other kings and the Lord's cowherd girlfriends were all amazed to hear of the Queen's deep love for Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead and soul of all beings, and their eyes filled with tears. As the women thus talked among themselves and the men among themselves, a number of great sages arrived there, all of them eager to see Lord Krishna and Lord Balaram. They included Vaipayana, Narada, Chavana, Devala, and Asita, Vishvamitra, Shatananda, Bharadvaj, and Gautama, Lord Parashuram and his disciples, Vasishta, Galava, Bhrigu, Pulastya, and Kashyapa, Atri, Markandeya, and Brihaspati, Dvita, Trita, Ekata, and the four Kumaras, and Angira, Agastya, Yajnavalkya, and Vamadev. As soon as they saw the sages approaching, the kings and other gentlemen who had been seated immediately stood up, including the Pandava brothers and Krishna and Balaram. They all then bowed down to the sages, who are honored throughout the universe. Lord Krishna, Lord Balaram, and the other kings and leaders properly worshiped the sages by offering them words of greeting, sitting places, water for washing their feet, drinking water, flower garlands, incense, and sandalwood paste. After the sages were comfortably seated, the Supreme Lord Krishna, whose transcendental body protects religious principles, addressed them in the midst of that great assembly. Everyone listened silently with rapt attention. The Supreme Lord said, "Now our lives are indeed successful, for we have obtained life's ultimate goal, the audience of great yoga masters, which even demigods only rarely obtain. How is it that people who are not very austere and who recognize God only in his deity form in the temple can now see you, touch you, inquire from you, bow down to you, worship your feet, and serve you in other ways? Mere bodies of water are not the real sacred places of pilgrimage, nor are mere images of earth and stone the true worshipable deities. These purify one only after a long time, but saintly sages purify one immediately upon being seen. Neither the demigods controlling fire, the sun, the moon, and the stars, nor those in charge of earth, water, ether, air, speech, and mind actually remove the sins of their worshippers, who continue to see in terms of dualities. But wise sages destroy one's sins when respectfully served for even a few moments. One who identifies his self as the inert body composed of mucus, bile, and air, who assumes his wife and family are permanently his own, who thinks an earthen image or the land of his birth is worshipable, or who sees a place of pilgrimage as merely the water there, but who never identifies himself with, feels kinship with, worships, or even visits those who are wise in spiritual truth, such a person is no better than a cow or an ass." Shukadev Goswami said, "Hearing such unfathomable words from the unlimitedly wise Lord Krishna, the learned Brahmins remained silent, their minds bewildered. For some time the sages pondered the Supreme Lord's behavior, which resembled that of a subordinate living being. They concluded that he was acting this way to instruct the people in general. Thus they smiled and spoke to him, the spiritual master of the universe. The great sages said, "Your power of illusion has totally bewildered us, the most exalted knowers of the truth and leaders among the universal creators. Ah, how amazing is the behavior of the Supreme Lord! He covers himself with his human-like activities and pretends to be subject to superior control. Indeed, the human-like pastimes of the Almighty are simply a pretense. Effortlessly, he alone sends forth from his self this variegated creation, maintains it, and then swallows it up again, all without becoming entangled, just as the element earth takes on many names and forms in its various transformations. Nonetheless, at suitable times you assume the pure mode of goodness to protect your devotees and punish the wicked. Thus you, the soul of the Varnashram social order, the supreme personality of Godhead, maintain the eternal path of the Vedas by enjoying your pleasure pastimes. The Vedas are your spotless heart, and through them one can perceive, by means of austerity, study, and self-control, the manifest, the unmanifest, and the pure existence transcendental to both. Therefore, O Supreme Brahman, you honor the members of the Brahminical community, for they are the perfect agents by which one can realize you through the evidence of the Vedas. For that very reason, you are the foremost worshiper of the Brahmins. Today, our birth, education, austerity, and vision have all become perfect because we have been able to associate with you, the goal of all saintly persons. Indeed, you yourself are the ultimate supreme blessing. Let us offer our obeisances unto that supreme personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, the infinitely intelligent supersoul, who has disguised his greatness through his mystic yoga maya. Neither these kings nor even the Vrishnis, who enjoy your intimate association, know you as the soul of all existence, the force of time, and the supreme controller. For them you are covered by the curtain of maya. A sleeping person imagines an alternative reality for himself, and seeing himself as having various names and forms, he forgets his waking identity, which is distinct from the dream. Similarly, the senses of one whose consciousness is bewildered by illusion perceive only the names and forms of material objects. Thus, such a person loses his memory and cannot know you. Today we have directly seen your feet, the source of the holy Ganges, which washes away volumes of sins. Perfected yogis can at best meditate upon your feet within their hearts, but only those who render you wholehearted devotional service and in this way vanquish the soul's covering, the material mind, attain you as their final destination. Therefore, kindly show mercy to us, your devotees. Shukadev Goswami said, having thus spoken, O wise king, the sages then took leave of Lord Krishna, Dhritarashtra, and Yudhisthira, and prepared to depart for their ashrams. Seeing that they were about to leave, the renowned Vasudev approached the sages. After bowing down to them and touching their feet, he spoke to them with carefully chosen words. Sri Vasudev said, obeisances to you, the residents of all the demigods. Please hear me, O sages. Kindly tell us how the reactions of one's work can be counteracted by further work. Sri Narada Muni said, O Brahmins, it is not so amazing that in his eagerness to know, Vasudev has asked us about his ultimate benefit, for he considers Krishna a mere boy. In this world, familiarity breeds contempt. For example, one who lives on the banks of the Ganges might travel to some other body of water to be purified. The Supreme Lord's awareness is never disturbed by time, by the creation and destruction of the universe, by changes in its own qualities, or by anything else, whether self-caused or external. But although the consciousness of the personality of Godhead, who is the Supreme One without a second, is never affected by material distress, by the reactions of material work, or by the constant flow of nature's modes, ordinary persons nonetheless think that the Lord is covered by his own creations of prana and other material elements, just as one may think that the sun is covered by clouds, snow, or an eclipse. Shukadev Goswami continued, the sages then spoke again, O King, addressing Vasudev while all the kings, along with Lord Achyuta and Lord Ram, listened. The sages said, it has been definitely concluded that work is counteracted by further work when one executes Vedic sacrifices as a means of worshipping Vishnu, the Lord of all sacrifices, with sincere faith. Learned authorities who see through the eye of scripture have demonstrated that this is the easiest method of subduing the agitated mind and attaining liberation, and that it is a sacred duty which brings joy to the heart. This is the most auspicious path for a religious householder of the twice-born orders, to selflessly worship the personality of Godhead with wealth honestly obtained. An intelligent person should learn to renounce his desire for wealth by performing sacrifices and acts of charity. He should learn to renounce his desire for a wife and children by experiencing family life. And he should learn to renounce his desire for promotion to a higher planet in his next life by studying the effects of time. Self-controlled sages who have thus renounced their attachment to household life go to the forest to perform austerities. Dear Vasudeva Prabhu, a member of the twice-born classes is born with three kinds of debts: those owed to the demigods, to the sages, and to his forefathers. If he leaves his body without first liquidating these debts by performing sacrifice, studying the scriptures, and begetting children, he will fall down into a hellish condition. But you, O magnanimous soul, are already free from two of your debts, those to the sages and the forefathers. Now absolve yourself of your debt to the demigods by executing Vedic sacrifices, and in this way free yourself completely of debt and renounce all material shelter. O Vasudev, without doubt you must have previously worshipped Lord Hari, the master of all worlds. Both you and your wife must have perfectly worshipped him with supreme devotion, since he has accepted the role of your son. Shukadev Goswami said, after hearing these statements of the sages, generous Vasudev bowed his head to the ground and, praising them, requested them to become his priests. Thus requested by him, the sages engaged the pious Vasudev in performing fire sacrifices at that holy place of Kurukshetra, according to strict religious principles and with most excellent ritual arrangements. When Maharaj Vasudev was about to be initiated for the sacrifice, the Vrishnis came to the initiation pavilion after bathing and putting on fine clothes and garlands of lotuses. The other kings also came, elaborately ornamented, as well as all their joyful queens, who wore jeweled lockets around their necks and were also clad in fine garments. The royal wives were anointed with sandalwood paste and carried auspicious items for the worship. Mridangas, patahas, conchels, berries, anakas, and other instruments resounded. Male and female dancers danced, and suttas and magadas recited glorifications. Sweet-voiced Gandharvis sang, accompanied by their husbands. After Vasudev's eyes had been decorated with black cosmetic and his body smeared with fresh butter, the priests initiated him according to scriptural rules by sprinkling him and his 18 wives with sacred water. Encircled by his wives, he resembled the regal moon encircled by stars. Vasudev received initiation along with his wives, who wore silk saris and were adorned with bangles, necklaces, ankle bells, and earrings. With his body wrapped in a deerskin, Vasudev shone splendidly. Vasudev's priests and the officiating members of the assembly, dressed in silk dhotis and jeweled ornaments, looked so effulgent that they seemed to be standing in the sacrificial arena of Indra, the killer of Vritra. At that time, Balaram and Krishna, the lords of all living entities, shone forth with great majesty in the company of their respective sons, wives, and other family members, who were expansions of their opulences. Performing various kinds of Vedic sacrifice according to the proper regulations, Vasudev worshipped the Lord of all sacrificial paraphernalia, mantras, and rituals. He executed both primary and secondary sacrifices, offering oblations to the sacred fire and carrying out other aspects of sacrificial worship. Then, at the appropriate time and according to scripture, Vasudev remunerated the priests by decorating them with precious ornaments, though they were already richly adorned, and offering them valuable gifts of cows, land, and marriageable girls. After supervising the Patni Sanyaja and Avabritya rituals, the great Brahmin sages bathed in Lord Parashuram's lake with the sponsor of the sacrifice, Vasudev, who led them. His sacred bath complete, Vasudev joined with his wives in giving the jewelry and clothes they had been wearing to the professional reciters. Vasudev then put on new garments, after which he honored all classes of people by feeding everyone, even the dogs. With opulent gifts, he honored his relatives, including all their wives and children. The royalty of the Vidarbha, Kosala, Kuru, Kashi, Kekaya, and Thrindriya kingdoms, the officiating members of the assembly, and also the priests, witnessing demigods, humans, spirits, forefathers, and charanas. Then, taking permission from Lord Krishna, the shelter of the goddess of fortune, the various guests departed as they all chanted the glories of Vasudev's sacrifice. The Yadus were all embraced by their friends, close family members, and other relatives, including Dhritarashtra and his younger brother, Vidura, Prita and her sons, Bhishma, Drona, the twins Nakula and Sahadev, Narada, and Vedavyas, the personality of Godhead. Their hearts melting with affection, these and the other guests left for their kingdoms, their progress slowed by the pain of separation. Nanda Maharaj showed his affection for his relatives, the Yadus, by remaining with them a little longer, together with his cowherds. During his stay, Krishna, Balaram, Ugrasen, and the others honored him with especially opulent worship. Having so easily crossed over the vast ocean of his ambition, Vasudeva felt fully satisfied. In the company of his many well-wishers, he took Nanda by the hand and addressed him as follows. My dear brother, God himself has tied the knot called affection, which tightly binds human beings together. It seems to me that even great heroes and mystics find it very difficult to free themselves from it. Indeed, the Supreme Lord must have created the bonds of affection, for such exalted saints as you have never stopped showing matchless friendship toward us ingrates, although it has never been properly reciprocated. Previously, dear brother, we did nothing to benefit you because we were unable to. Yet even now that you are present before us, our eyes are so blinded by the intoxication of material good fortune that we continue to ignore you. O most respectful one, may a person who wants the highest benefit in life never gain kingly opulence, for it leaves him blind to the needs of his own family and friends. Sri Shukadev Goswami said, his heart softened by feelings of intimate sympathy, Vasudev wept. His eyes brimmed with tears as he remembered the friendship Nanda had shown him. And on his part, Nanda was also full of affection for his friend Vasudev. Thus, during the following days, Nanda would repeatedly announce, I will be leaving later today, and I will be leaving tomorrow. But out of love for Krishna and Balaram, he remained there for 3 more months, honored by all the Yadus. Then, after Vasudev, Ugrasen, Krishna, Uddhava, Balaram, and others had fulfilled his desires and presented him with precious ornaments, fine linen, and varieties of priceless household furnishings, Nanda Maharaj accepted all these gifts and took his leave. Seen off by all the Yadus, he departed with his family members and the residents of Braja. Unable to withdraw their minds from Lord Govinda's lotus feet, where they had surrendered them, Nanda and the cowherd men and women returned to Mathura. Their relatives having thus departed, and seeing that the rainy season was approaching, the Vrishnis, whose only lord was Krishna, went back to Dwaraka. They told the people of the city about the festive sacrifices performed by Vasudev, Lord of the Yadus, and about everything else that had happened during their pilgrimage, especially how they had met with all their loved ones. Chapter 85. Lord Krishna instructs Vasudev and retrieves Devaki's dead sons. Sri Shukadev Goswami said, one day the two sons of Vasudev, Krishna and Balaram, came to pay him respects, bowing down at his feet. Vasudev greeted them with great affection and spoke to them. Having heard the great sage's words concerning the power of his two sons, and having seen their valorous deeds, Vasudev became convinced of their divinity. Thus, addressing them by name, he spoke to them as follows. O Krishna, Krishna, best of yogis, O eternal Sankarshan, I know that you too are personally the source of universal creation and the ingredients of creation as well. You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who manifests as the Lord of both nature and the Creator of nature, Mahavishnu. Everything that comes into existence, however and whenever it does so, is created within you, by you, from you, for you, and in relation to you. O Transcendental Lord, from yourself you created this entire variegated universe, and then you entered within it in your personal form as the Supersoul. In this way, O unborn Supreme Soul, as the life force and consciousness of everyone, you maintain the creation. Whatever potencies the life air and other elements of universal creation exhibit are actually all personal energies of the Supreme Lord, for both life and matter are subordinate to him and dependent on him, and also different from one another. Thus everything active in the material world is set into motion by the Supreme Lord. The glow of the moon, the brilliance of fire, the radiance of the sun, the twinkling of the stars, the flash of lightning, the permanence of mountains, and the aroma and sustaining power of the earth, all these are actually you. My Lord, you are water, and also its taste and its capacities to quench thirst and sustain life. You exhibit your potencies through the manifestations of the air as bodily warmth, vitality, mental power, physical strength, endeavor, and movement. You are the directions and their accommodating capacity, the all-pervading ether and the elemental sound residing within it. You are the primeval, unmanifested form of sound, the first syllable, om, and audible speech by which sound, as words, acquires particular references. You are the power of the senses to reveal their objects, the senses presiding demigods, and the sanction these demigods give for sensory activity. You are the capacity of the intelligence for decision-making, and the living being's ability to remember things accurately. You are false ego in the mode of ignorance, which is the source of the physical elements, false ego in the mode of passion, which is the source of the bodily senses, false ego in the mode of goodness, which is the source of the demigods, and the unmanifest total material energy, which underlies everything. You are the one indestructible entity among all the destructible things of this world, like the underlying substance that is seen to remain unchanged while the things made from it undergo transformations. The modes of material nature, namely goodness, passion, and ignorance, together with all their functions, become directly manifest within you, the Supreme Absolute Truth, by the arrangement of your Yogamaya. Thus, these created entities, transformations of material nature, do not exist except when material nature manifests them within you, at which time you also manifest within them. But aside from such periods of creation, you stand alone as the transcendental reality. They are truly ignorant who, while imprisoned within the ceaseless flow of this world's material qualities, fail to know you, the supreme soul of all that be, as their ultimate sublime destination. Because of their ignorance, the entanglement of material work forces such souls to wander in the cycle of birth and death. By good fortune, a soul may obtain a healthy human life, an opportunity rarely achieved. But if he is nonetheless deluded about what is best for him, O Lord, your illusory Maya will cause him to waste his entire life. You keep this whole world bound up by the ropes of affection, and thus when people consider their material bodies, they think, "This is me." And when they consider their progeny and other relations, they think, "These are mine." You are not our sons, but the very lords of both material nature and its creator, Mahavishnu. As you yourself have told us, you have descended to rid the earth of the rulers who are a heavy burden upon her. Therefore, O friend of the distressed, I now approach your lotus feet for shelter, the same lotus feet that dispel all fear of worldly existence for those who have surrendered to them. Enough! Enough with hankering for sense enjoyment, which makes me identify with this mortal body and think of you, the Supreme, as my child. Indeed, while still in the maternity room, you told us that you, the unborn Lord, had already been born several times as our son in previous ages. After manifesting each of these transcendental bodies to protect your own principles of religion, you then made them unmanifest, thus appearing and disappearing like a cloud. O supremely glorified, all-pervading Lord, who can understand the mystic, deluding potency of your opulent expansions? Shukadeva Goswami said, having heard his father's words, the Supreme Lord, leader of the Satvatas, replied in a gentle voice as he bowed his head in humility and smiled. The Supreme Lord said, my dear father, I consider your statements appropriate, since you have explained the various categories of existence by referring to us, your sons. Not only I, but also you, along with my respected brother and these residents of Dwaraka, should all be considered in this same philosophical light, O best of the Yarus. Indeed, we should include all that exists, both moving and non-moving. The Supreme Spirit, Paramatma, is indeed one. He is self-luminous and eternal, transcendental and devoid of material qualities. But through the agency of the very modes he has created, the one supreme truth manifests as many among the expansions of these modes. The elements of ether, air, fire, water, and earth become visible, invisible, minute, or extensive as they manifest in various objects. Similarly, the Paramatma, though one, appears to be many. Shukadeva Goswami said, O King, hearing these instructions spoken to him by the Supreme Lord, Vasudeva became freed from all ideas of duality. Satisfied at heart, he remained silent. At that time, the universally worshipped Devaki took the opportunity to address her two sons, Krishna and Balaram. Previously, she had heard with astonishment that they had brought their spiritual master's son back from death. Now, thinking of her own sons who had been murdered by Kamsa, she felt great sorrow, and thus, with tear-filled eyes, she beseeched Krishna and Balaram. Sri Devaki said, "O Rama, Rama, immeasurable supreme soul, O Krishna, Lord of all masters of yoga, I know that you are the ultimate rulers of all universal creators, the primeval personalities of Godhead. Taking birth from me, you have now descended to this world in order to kill those kings whose good qualities have been destroyed by the present age, and who thus defy the authority of revealed scriptures and burden the earth. O soul of all that be, the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the universe are all carried out by a fraction of an expansion of an expansion of your expansion. Today I have come to take shelter of you, the Supreme Lord. It is said that when your spiritual master ordered you to retrieve his long-dead son, you brought him back from the forefathers' abode as a token of remuneration for your guru's mercy. Please fulfill my desire in the same way, O supreme masters of all yoga masters. Please bring back my sons who were killed by the king of Bhoja, so that I may see them once again." Shukadeva Goswami said, "Thus entreated by their mother, Balaram and Krishna employed their mystic yogamaya potency and entered the region of Sutala. When the king of the Daityas, Bali Maharaj, noticed the arrival of the two lords, his heart overflowed with joy, since he knew them to be the supreme soul and worshipable deity of the entire universe, and especially of himself. He immediately stood up and then bowed down to offer respects, along with his entire entourage. Bali took pleasure in offering them elevated seats. After they sat down, he washed the feet of the two supreme personalities. Then he took that water, which purifies the whole world, even up to Lord Brahma, and poured it upon himself and his followers. He worshipped them with all the riches at his disposal: priceless clothing, ornaments, fragrant sandalwood paste, betel nut, lamps, sumptuous food, and so on. Thus he offered them all his family's wealth and also his own self. Taking hold of the Lord's lotus feet again and again, Bali, the conqueror of Indra's army, spoke from his heart, which was melting out of his intense love. As tears of ecstasy filled his eyes and the hair on his limbs stood on end, he began to speak with faltering words. Obeisances to the unlimited Lord Ananta, the greatest of all beings, and obeisances to Lord Krishna, the creator of the universe, who appears as the impersonal absolute and the supersoul in order to disseminate the principles of Sankhya and Yoga. Seeing you, lords, is a rare achievement for most living beings, but even persons like us, situated in the modes of passion and ignorance, can easily see you when you reveal yourself by your own sweet will. Many who had been constantly absorbed in enmity toward you ultimately became attracted to you, who are the direct embodiment of transcendental goodness and whose divine form comprises the revealed scriptures. These reformed enemies include Daityas, Danavas, Gandharvas, Siddhas, Vidyadharas, Charanas, Yakshas, Rakshasas, Pishachas, Bhutas, Pramatas, and Nayakas, and also ourselves and many others like us. Some of us have become attracted to you because of exceptional hatred, while others have become attracted because of their mood of devotion based on lust. But the demigods and others infatuated by material goodness feel no such attraction for you. What to speak of ourselves, O Lord of all perfect yogis? Even the greatest mystics do not know what your spiritual power of delusion is or how it acts. Please be merciful to me so I may get out of the blind well of family life, my false home, and find the true shelter of your lotus feet, which selfless sages always seek. Then, either alone or in the company of great saints, who are the friends of everyone, I may wander freely, finding life's necessities at the feet of the universally charitable trees. O Lord of all subordinate creatures, please tell us what to do and thus free us of all sin. One who faithfully executes your command, O Master, is no longer obliged to follow the ordinary Vedic rites." The Supreme Lord said, "During the age of the first Manu, the sage Marichi had six sons by his wife Urna. They were all exalted demigods, but once they laughed at Lord Brahma when they saw him preparing to have sex with his own daughter. Because of that improper act, they immediately entered a demoniac form of life, and thus they took birth as sons of Hiranyakashipu. The goddess Yogamaya then took them away from Hiranyakashipu, and they were born again from Devaki's womb. After this, O king, Kamsa murdered them. Devaki still laments for them, thinking of them as her sons. These same sons of Marichi are now living here with you. We wish to take them from this place to dispel their mother's sorrow. Then, released from their curse and free from all suffering, they will return to their home in heaven. By my grace, these six, Smara, Udgita, Parishranga, Patanga, Chudnabrit, and Grini, will return to the abode of pure saints. After saying this, Lord Krishna and Lord Balaram, having been duly worshipped by Bali Maharaj, took the six sons and returned to Dwaraka, where they presented them to their mother. When she saw her lost children, Goddess Devaki felt such affection for them that milk flowed from her breasts. She embraced them and took them onto her lap, smelling their heads again and again. Lovingly, she let her sons drink from her breast, which became wet with milk just by their touch. She was entranced by the same illusory energy of Lord Vishnu that initiates the creation of the universe. By drinking her nectarian milk, the remnants of what Krishna himself had previously drunk, the six sons touched the transcendental body of the Lord, Narayan, and this contact awakened them to their original identities. They bow down to Govinda, Devaki, their father, and Balaram, and then, as everyone looked on, they left for the abode of the demigods. Seeing her sons return from death and then depart again, saintly Devaki was struck with wonder, O king. She concluded that this was all simply an illusion created by Krishna. Sri Krishna, the Supreme Soul, the Lord of unlimited valor, performed countless pastimes just as amazing as this one, O descendant of Bharat. Sri Suta Goswami said, "This pastime enacted by Lord Murari, whose fame is eternal, totally destroys the sins of the universe and serves as the transcendental ornament for his devotees' ears. Anyone who carefully hears or narrates this pastime, as recounted by the venerable son of Vyas, will be able to fix his mind in meditation on the Supreme Lord and attain to the all-auspicious kingdom of God." Chapter 86. Arjuna kidnaps Subhadra and Krishna blesses his devotees. King Parikshit said, "O Brahman, we would like to learn how Arjuna married Lord Balaram's and Lord Krishna's sister, who was my grandmother." Shukadev Goswami said, "While traveling far and wide, visiting various holy places of pilgrimage, Arjuna came to Prabhas. There he heard that Lord Balaram intended to give his maternal cousin Subhadra to Duryodhana in marriage, and that no one else approved of this plan. Arjuna wanted to marry her himself, so he disguised himself as a renunciant, complete with triple staff, and went to Dwaraka. He stayed there during the monsoon months to fulfill his purpose. Lord Balaram and the other residents of the city, not recognizing him, offered him all honor and hospitality. One day, Lord Balaram brought him to his home as his invited dinner guest, and Arjuna ate the food the Lord respectfully offered him. There he saw the wonderful maiden Subhadra, who was enchanting to heroes. His eyes opened wide with delight, and his mind became agitated and absorbed in thoughts of her. Arjuna was very attractive to women, and as soon as Subhadra saw him, she wanted to have him as her husband. Smiling bashfully with sidelong glances, she fixed her heart and eyes upon him. Meditating only on her and waiting for the opportunity to take her away, Arjuna had no peace. His heart trembled with passionate desire. Once, on the occasion of a great temple festival in honor of the Supreme Lord, Subhadra rode out of the fortress-like palace on a chariot, and at that time the mighty chariot warrior Arjuna took the opportunity to kidnap her. Subhadra's parents and Krishna had sanctioned this. Standing on his chariot, Arjuna took up his bow and drove off the valiant fighters and palace guards who tried to block his way. As her relatives shouted in anger, he took Subhadra away just as a lion takes his prey from the midst of lesser animals. When he heard of Subhadra's kidnapping, Lord Balaram became as disturbed as the ocean during the full moon. But Lord Krishna respectfully took hold of his feet and, together with other family members, pacified him by explaining the matter. Lord Balaram then happily sent the bride and groom very valuable wedding gifts consisting of elephants, chariots, horses, and male and female servants. Shukadev Goswami continued, "There was a devotee of Krishna's known as Shukadev, who was a first-class Brahmin. Perfectly satisfied by rendering unalloyed devotional service to Lord Krishna, he was peaceful, learned, and free from sense gratification. Living as a religious householder in the city of Mithila, within the kingdom of Videha, he managed to fulfill his obligations while maintaining himself with whatever sustenance easily came his way. By the will of Providence, he obtained each day just what he needed for his maintenance, and no more. Satisfied with this much, he properly executed his religious duties. Similarly free from false ego was the ruler of that kingdom, my dear Parikshit, a descendant of the Mithila dynasty named Bahulashva. Both these devotees were very dear to Lord Achyuta. Pleased with both of them, the Supreme Personality of Godhead mounted his chariot, which Dwarka had brought, and traveled to Videha with a group of sages. Among these sages were Narada, Vamadev, Atri, Krishna Dvaipayan of Vyas, Parashuram, Asita, Aruni, myself, Brihaspati, Kanva, Maitreya, and Chavana. In every city and town the Lord passed along the way, the people came forward to worship him with offerings of argya water in their hands, as if to worship the risen sun surrounded by planets. The men and women of Anarta, Dhanva, Kurujangala, Kanka, Matsya, Panchala, Kunti, Madhu, Kekaya, Kosala, Arna, and many other kingdoms drank with their eyes the nectarian beauty of Lord Krishna's lotus-like face, which was graced with generous smiles and affectionate glances. Simply by glancing at those who came to see him, Lord Krishna, the spiritual master of the three worlds, delivered them from the blindness of materialism. As he thus endowed them with fearlessness and divine vision, he heard demigods and men sing his glories, which purify the entire universe and destroy all misfortune. Gradually, he reached Videha. Hearing that Lord Achyuta had arrived, the residents of the cities and villages of Videha joyfully came forth to receive him with offerings in their hands. As soon as the people saw Lord Krishna, their faces and hearts blossomed with affection. Joining their palms above their heads, they bowed down to the Lord and to the sages accompanying him, whom they had previously only heard about. Both the king of Mithila and Shukadev fell at the Lord's feet, each thinking that the spiritual master of the universe had come there just to show him mercy. At exactly the same time, King Bahulashva and Shukadev each went forward with joined palms and invited Lord Krishna to be his guest, along with the Brahmin sages. Wanting to please them both, the Lord accepted both their invitations. Thus he simultaneously went to both homes, and neither could see him entering the other's house. When King Bahulashva, a descendant of Janaka, saw Lord Krishna approaching his house from a distance with the sages, who were somewhat fatigued from the journey, he immediately arranged to have seats of honor brought out for them. After they were all comfortably seated, the wise king, his heart overflowing with joy and his eyes clouded by tears, bowed down to them and washed their feet with intense devotion. Taking the wash water, which could purify the entire world, he sprinkled it on his head and the heads of his family members. Then he worshipped all those great lords by offering them fragrant sandalwood paste, flower garlands, fine clothing and ornaments, incense, lamps, argya, and cows and bulls. When they had eaten to their full satisfaction, for their further pleasure, the king began to speak slowly and in a gentle voice as he held Lord Vishnu's feet in his lap and happily massaged them. Sri Bahulashva said, "O Almighty Lord, you are the soul of all created beings, their self-illumined witness, and now you are giving your audience to us who constantly meditate on your lotus feet. You have said, 'Neither Ananta, Goddess Sri, nor unborn Brahma is dearer to me than my unalloyed devotee.' To prove your own words true, you have now revealed yourself to our eyes. What person who knows this truth would ever abandon your lotus feet when you are ready to give your very self to peaceful sages who call nothing their own? Appearing in the Yadu dynasty, you have spread your glories, which can remove all the sins of the three worlds, just to deliver those entrapped in the cycle of birth and death. Obeisances to you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, whose intelligence is ever unrestricted. Obeisances to the sage Naranarayan, who always undergoes austerities in perfect peace. Please stay a few days in our house, along with these Brahmins, O All-Pervading One, and with the dust of your feet sanctify the dynasty of Nimi." Shukadev Goswami continued, "Thus invited by the king, the Supreme Lord, Sustainer of the World, consented to stay for some time to bestow good fortune on the men and women of Mithila. Shrutadev received Lord Achyuta in his home with the same enthusiasm as King Bahulastra had shown. After bowing down to him and the sages, he began to dance with great joy, waving his shawl. After bringing mats of grass and darba straw and seating his guests upon them, he greeted them with words of welcome. Then he and his wife washed their feet with great pleasure. With the washed water, the virtuous Shrutadev copiously sprinkled himself, his house, and his family. Overjoyed, he felt that all his desires had now been fulfilled. He worshipped them with offerings of auspicious items easily available to him, such as fruits, ushira root, pure nectarian water, fragrant clay, tulsi leaves, kusha grass, and lotus flowers. Then he offered them food that increases the mode of goodness. He wondered, how is it that I, fallen into the blind well of family life, have been able to meet Lord Krishna? And how have I also been allowed to meet these great Brahmins, who always carry the Lord within their hearts? Indeed, the dust of their feet is the shelter of all holy places. When his guests were seated comfortably, having each received a proper welcome, Shrutadev approached them and sat down nearby with his wife, children, and other dependents. Then, while massaging the Lord's feet, he addressed Krishna and the sages. It is not that we have attained the audience of the Supreme Person only today, for we have in fact been associating with him ever since he created this universe with his energies and then entered it in his transcendental form. The Lord is like a sleeping person who creates a separate world in his imagination and then enters his own dream and sees himself within it. You reveal yourself within the hearts of those persons of pure consciousness who constantly hear about you, chant about you, worship you, glorify you, and converse with one another about you. But although you reside within the heart, you are very far away from those whose minds are disturbed by their entanglement in material work. Indeed, no one can grasp you by his material powers, for you reveal yourself only in the hearts of those who have learned to appreciate your transcendental qualities. Let me offer my obeisances unto you. You are realized as the Supreme Soul by those who know the Absolute Truth, whereas in your form of time you impose death upon the forgetful souls. You appear both in your causeless spiritual form and in the created form of this universe, thus simultaneously uncovering the eyes of your devotees and obstructing the vision of the non-devotees. O Lord, you are that Supreme Soul, and we are your servants. How shall we serve you? My Lord, simply seeing you puts an end to all the troubles of human life. Sri Shukadev Goswami said, after hearing Shrutadev speak these words, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who relieves his surrendered devotee's distress, took Shrutadev's hand in his own and, smiling, spoke to him as follows. My dear Brahman, you should know that these great sages have come here just to bless you. They travel throughout the worlds with me, purifying them with the dust of their feet. One can gradually become purified by seeing, touching, and worshipping temple deities, places of pilgrimage, and holy rivers, but one can attain the same result immediately simply by receiving the glance of exalted sages. By his very birth, a Brahman is the best of all living beings in this world, and he becomes even more exalted when he is endowed with austerity, learning, and self-satisfaction, what to speak of devotion to me. Even my own four-armed form is no dearer to me than a Brahman. Within himself, a learned Brahman comprises all the Vedas, just as within myself, I comprise all the demigods. Ignorant of this truth, foolish people neglect and enviously offend a learned Brahman, who, being non-different from me, is their spiritual master and very self. They consider worshipable only such obvious manifestations of divinity as my deity form. Because he has realized me, a Brahman is firmly fixed in the knowledge that everything moving and non-moving in the universe, and also the primary elements of its creation, are all manifest forms expanded from me. Therefore, you should worship these Brahman sages, O Brahman, with the same faith you have in me. If you do so, you will worship me directly, which you cannot do otherwise, even with offerings of vast riches. Sri Shukadev Goswami said, so instructed by his Lord, with single-minded devotion, Shrutadev worshipped Sri Krishna and the topmost Brahmins accompanying him, and King Bahulashva did the same. Thus both Shrutadev and the king attained the ultimate transcendental destination. O King, thus the Personality of Godhead, who is devoted to his own devotees, stayed for some time with his two great devotees, Shutadeva and Bahulashtra, teaching them the behavior of perfect saints. Then the Lord returned to Dwarka. Chapter 87, The Prayers of the Personified Vedas. Sri Parikshit said, O Brahman, how can the Vedas directly describe the Supreme Absolute Truth, who cannot be described in words? The Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature, but the Supreme is devoid of these qualities, being transcendental to all material manifestations and their causes. Shukadeva Goswami said, The Supreme Lord manifested the material intelligence, senses, mind, and vital air of the living entities so that they could indulge their desires for sense gratification, take repeated births to engage in fruitive activities, become elevated in future lives, and ultimately attain liberation. Those who came before even our ancient predecessors meditated upon this same confidential knowledge of the Absolute Truth. Indeed, anyone who faithfully concentrates on this knowledge will become free from material attachments and attain the final goal of life. In this connection, I will relate to you a narration concerning the Supreme Lord Narayan. It is about a conversation that once occurred between Sri Narayan Rishi and Narada Muni. Once, while traveling among the various planets of the universe, the Lord's beloved devotee Narada went to visit the primeval sage Narayan at his ashram. From the very beginning of Brahma's day, Lord Narayan Rishi has been undergoing austere penances in this land of Bharata while perfectly performing religious duties and exemplifying spiritual knowledge and self-control, all for the benefit of human beings in both this world and the next. There, Narada approached Lord Narayan Rishi, who was sitting amidst sages of the village Kalapa. After bowing down to the Lord, Narada asked him the very same question you have asked me. As the sages listened, Lord Narayan Rishi related to Narada an ancient discussion about the Absolute Truth that took place among the residents of Janaloka. The personality of Godhead said, O son of self-born Brahma, once long ago on Janaloka, wise sages who resided there performed a great sacrifice to the Absolute Truth by vibrating transcendental sounds. These sages, mental sons of Brahma, were all perfect celibates. At that time, you happened to be visiting the Lord on Shvetadvip, that supreme Lord in whom the Vedas lie down to rest during the period of universal annihilation. A lively discussion arose among the sages on Janaloka as to the nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth. Indeed, the same question arose then that you are asking me now. Although these sages were all equally qualified in terms of Vedic study and austerity, and although they all saw friends, enemies, and neutral parties equally, they chose one of their number to be the speaker, and the rest became eager listeners. Sri Sanandana Kumara replied, After the Supreme Lord withdrew the universe he had previously created, he lay for some time as if asleep, and all his energies rested dormant within him. When the time came for the next creation, the personified Vedas awakened him by chanting his glories, just as the poets serving a king approach him at dawn and awaken him by reciting his heroic deeds. Shri Shrutayuhu Chu Jaya 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 Jama Dita Dosh Gabita Gurunam Tomasiya Ratmana Samavarudna Samastabhaga Aga Jagaroka Samakila Shakchava Bodhakati Kachada Jayatmana Chachadato Nachare Nagama Brihadubalabda Meta Davayan Devashishataya Yata Udayastama Yovikate Mediva Vikata Atarishi Yoda Dusta Himano Vachana Chaditam Katamayata Bhavanti Bhuvadatta Padani Nirnam Iti Tava Suri Yastridipate Kila Lokamala Chapanakatam Metabdima Bhagayata Pansi Jahu Kimutaponak Sadama Vidutashi Yakala Guna Padama Bhajandi Padama Jasisukanu Bhavam The Shruti said, Victory, victory to you, O unconquerable one. By your very nature, you are perfectly full in all opulences. Therefore, please defeat the eternal power of illusion, who assumes control over the modes of nature to create difficulties for conditioned souls. O you who awaken all the energies of the moving and non-moving embodied beings, sometimes the Vedas can recognize you as you sport with your material and spiritual potencies. This perceivable world is identified with the Supreme because the Supreme Brahman is the ultimate foundation of all existence, remaining unchanged as all created things are generated from it and at last dissolved into it, just as clay remains unchanged by the products made from it and again merged with it. Thus it is toward you alone that the Vedic sages direct all their thoughts, words, and acts. After all, how can the footsteps of men fail to touch the earth on which they live? Therefore, O Master of the Three Worlds, the wise get rid of all misery by diving deep into the nectarian ocean of topics about you, which washes away all the contamination of the universe. Then what to speak of those who, having by spiritual strength rid their minds of bad habits and freed themselves from time, are able to worship your true nature, O Supreme One, finding within it uninterrupted bliss? Only if they become your faithful followers are those who breathe actually alive. Otherwise, their breathing is like that of a bellows. It is by your mercy alone that the elements, beginning with the bellows, it is by your mercy alone that the elements, beginning with the Mahat Tattva and false ego, created the egg of this universe. Among the manifestations known as Anamoya and so forth, you are the ultimate one, entering within the material coverings along with the living entity and assuming the same forms as those he takes. Distinct from the gross and subtle material manifestations, you are the reality underlying them all. Among the followers of the methods set forth by great sages, those with less refined vision worship the Supreme as present in the region of the abdomen, while the Aronis worship him as present in the heart, in the subtle center from which all the pranic channels emanate. From there, O Unlimited Lord, these worshippers raise their consciousness upward to the top of the head, where they can perceive you directly. Then, passing through the top of the head toward the supreme destination, they reach that place from which they will never again fall into this world, into the mouth of death. Apparently entering among the variegated species of living beings you have created, you inspire them to act, manifesting yourself according to their higher and lower positions, just as fire manifests differently according to the shape of what it burns. Therefore, those of spotless intelligence, who are altogether free from material attachments, realize your undifferentiated, unchanging self to be the permanent reality among all these impermanent life forms. The individual living entity, while inhabiting the material bodies he has created for himself by his karma, actually remains uncovered by either gross or subtle matter. This is so because, as the Vedas describe, he is part and parcel of you, the possessor of all potencies. Having determined this to be the status of the living entity, learned sages become imbued with faith and worship your lotus feet, to which all Vedic sacrifices in this world are offered, and which are the source of liberation. My Lord, some fortunate souls have gotten relief from the fatigue of material life by diving into the vast nectar ocean of your pastimes, which you enact when you manifest your personal forms to propagate the unfathomable science of the self. These rare souls, indifferent even to liberation, renounce the happiness of home and family because of their association with devotees who are like flocks of swans enjoying at the lotus of your feet. When this human body is used for your devotional service, it acts as oneself, friend and beloved. But unfortunately, although you always show mercy to the conditioned souls and affectionately help them in every way, and although you are their true self, people in general fail to delight in you. Instead, they commit spiritual suicide by worshipping illusion. Alas, because they persistently hope for success in their devotion to the unreal, they continue to wander about this greatly fearful world, assuming various degraded bodies. Simply by constantly thinking of him, the enemies of the Lord attain the same supreme truth whom sages fixed in yoga worship by controlling their breath, mind, and senses. Similarly, we Shrutis, who generally see you as all-pervading, will achieve the same nectar from your lotus feet that your consorts are able to relish because of their loving attraction to your mighty serpentine arms, for you look upon us and your consorts in the same way. Everyone in this world has recently been born and will soon die. So how can anyone here know him who existed prior to everything else and who gave rise to the first learned sage, Brahma, and all subsequent demigods, both lesser and greater? When he lies down and withdraws everything within himself, nothing else remains, no gross or subtle matter or bodies composed of these, no force of time or revealed scripture. Supposed authorities who declare that matter is the origin of existence that the permanent qualities of the soul can be destroyed, that the self is compounded of separate aspects of spirit and matter, or that material transactions constitute reality. All such authorities base their teachings on mistaken ideas that hide the truth. The dualistic conception that the living entity is produced from the three modes of nature is simply a product of ignorance. Such a conception has no real basis in you, for you are transcendental to all illusion and always enjoy perfect, total awareness. The three modes of material nature comprise everything in this world, from the simplest phenomena to the complex human body. Although these phenomena appear real, they are only a false reflection of the spiritual reality, being a superimposition of the mind upon you. Still, those who know the Supreme Self consider the entire material creation to be real inasmuch as it is non-different from the Self. Just as things made of gold are indeed not to be rejected, since their substance is actual gold, so this world is undoubtedly non-different from the Lord who created it and then entered within it. The devotees who worship you as the shelter of all beings disregard death and place their feet on his head. But with the words of the Vedas you bind the non-devotees like animals, though they be vastly learned scholars. It is your affectionate devotees who can purify themselves and others, not those who are inimical to you. Though you have no material senses, you are the self-effulgent sustainer of everyone's sensory powers. The demigods and material nature herself offer you tribute, while also enjoying the tribute offered them by their worshippers. Just as subordinate rulers of various districts in a kingdom offer tribute to their lord, the ultimate proprietor of the land, while also enjoying the tribute paid them by their own subjects. In this way, the universal creators faithfully execute their assigned services out of fear of you. O eternally liberated transcendental Lord, your material energy causes the various moving and non-moving species of life to appear by activating their material desires, but only when and if you sport with her by briefly glancing at her. You, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, see no one as an intimate friend and no one as a stranger, just as the ethereal sky has no connection with perceptible qualities. In this sense, you resemble a void. If the countless living entities were all pervading and possessed forms that never changed, you could not possibly be their absolute ruler, O immutable one. But since they are your localized expansions and their forms are subject to change, you do control them. Indeed, that which supplies the ingredients for the generation of something is necessarily its controller, because a product never exists apart from its ingredient cause. It is simply illusion for someone to think that he knows the Supreme Lord, who is equally present in each of his expansions, since whatever knowledge one gains by material means must be imperfect. Neither material nature nor the soul who tries to enjoy her are ever born, yet living bodies come into being when these two combine, just as bubbles form where water meets the air. And just as rivers merge into the ocean or the nectar from many different flowers blends into honey, so all these conditioned beings eventually merge back into you, the Supreme, along with their various names and qualities. The wise souls who understand how your Maya deludes all human beings render potent loving service to you, who are the source of liberation from birth and death. How indeed can fear of material life affect your faithful servants? On the other hand, your furrowing eyebrows, the triple-rimmed wheel of time, repeatedly terrifies those who refuse to take shelter of you. The mind is like an impetuous horse that even persons who have regulated their senses and breath cannot control. Those in this world who try to tame the uncontrolled mind, but who abandon the feet of their spiritual master, encounter hundreds of obstacles in their cultivation of various distressful practices. O unborn Lord, they are like merchants on a boat in the ocean who have failed to employ a helmsman. To those persons who take shelter of you, you reveal yourself as the Supersoul, the embodiment of all transcendental pleasure. What further use have such devotees for their servants, children, or bodies, their wives, money, or houses, their land, good health, or conveyances? And for those who fail to appreciate the truth about you and go on pursuing the pleasures of sex, what could there be in this entire world, a place inherently doomed to destruction and devoid of significance, that could give them real happiness? Sages free from false pride live on this earth by frequenting the sacred pilgrimage sites and those places where the Supreme Lord displayed his pastimes. Because such devotees keep your lotus feet within their hearts, the water that washes their feet destroys all sins. Anyone who even once turns his mind toward you, the ever-blissful soul of all existence, no longer dedicates himself to serving family life at home, which simply robs a man of his good qualities. It may be proposed that this world is permanently real because it is generated from the permanent reality, but such an argument is subject to logical refutation. Sometimes, indeed, the apparent non-difference of a cause and its effect fails to prove true, and at other times the product of something real is illusory. Furthermore, this world cannot be permanently real, for it partakes of the natures of not only the absolute reality, but also the illusion that disguises that reality. Actually, the visible forms of this world are just an imaginary arrangement resorted to by a succession of ignorant persons in order to facilitate their material affairs. With their various meanings and implications, the learned words of your Vedas bewilder all persons whose minds have been dulled by hearing the incantations of sacrificial rituals. Since this universe did not exist prior to its creation and will no longer exist after its annihilation, we conclude that in the interim it is nothing more than a manifestation imagined to be visible within you, whose spiritual enjoyment never changes. We liken this universe to the transformation of various material substances into diverse forms. Certainly those who believe that this figment of the imagination is substantially real are less intelligent. The illusory material nature attracts the minute living entity to embrace her, and as a result he assumes forms composed of her qualities. Subsequently, he loses all his spiritual qualities and must undergo repeated deaths. You, however, avoid the material energy in the same way that a snake abandons its old skin. Glorious in your possession of 8 mystic perfections, you enjoy unlimited opulences. Members of the renounced order who fail to uproot the last traces of material desire in their hearts remain impure, and thus you do not allow them to understand you. Although you are present within their hearts, for them you are like a jewel worn around the neck of a man who has totally forgotten it is there. O Lord, those who practice yoga only for sense gratification must suffer punishment both in this life and the next, from death, who will not release them, and from you, whose kingdom they cannot reach. When a person realizes you, he no longer cares about his good and bad fortune arising from past pious and sinful acts, since it is you alone who control this good and bad fortune. Such a realized devotee also disregards what ordinary living beings say about him. Every day he fills his ears with your glories, which are recited in each age by the unbroken succession of Manu's descendants, and thus you become his ultimate salvation. Because you are unlimited, neither the lords of heaven nor even you yourself can ever reach the end of your glories. The countless universes, each enveloped in its shell, are compelled by the wheel of time to wander within you, like particles of dust blowing about in the sky. The Shrutis, following their method of eliminating everything separate from the Supreme, become successful by revealing you as their final conclusion. The Supreme Lord, Sri Narayan Rishi, said, "Having heard these instructions about the Supreme Self, the personality of Godhead, the sons of Brahma now understood their final destination. They felt perfectly satisfied and honored Sanandana with their worship. Thus the ancient saints who travel in the upper heavens distill this nectarian and confidential essence of all the Vedas and Puranas. As you wander the earth at will, my dear son of Brahma, you should faithfully meditate on these instructions concerning the science of the self, which burn up the material desires of all men." Shukadev Goswami said, "When Sri Narayan Rishi ordered him in this way, the self-possessed sage Narada, whose vow is as heroic as a warrior's, accepted the command with firm faith. Now successful in all his purposes, he thought about what he had heard and replied to the Lord as follows. Sri Narada said, "I offer my obeisances to him of spotless fame, the Supreme Lord, Krishna, who manifests his all-attractive personal expansions so that all living beings can achieve liberation." Shukadev Goswami continued, "After saying this, Narada bowed down to Sri Narayan Rishi, the foremost of sages, and also to his saintly disciples. He then returned to the hermitage of my father, Vaipayana Vyas. Vyasadev, the incarnation of the personality of Godhead, respectfully greeted Narada Muni and offered him a seat, which he accepted. Narada then described to Vyas what he had heard from the mouth of Sri Narayan Rishi. "Thus I have replied to the question you asked me, O King, concerning how the mind can have access to the absolute truth, which is indescribable by material words and devoid of material qualities. He is the Lord who eternally watches over this universe, who exists before, during, and after its manifestation. He is the master of both the unmanifest material energy and the spirit soul. After sending forth the creation, he enters within it, accompanying each living entity. There he creates the material bodies and then remains as their regulator. By surrendering to him, one can escape the embrace of illusion, just as a dreaming person forgets his own body. One who wants liberation from fear should constantly meditate upon him, Lord Hari, who is always on the platform of perfection and thus never subject to material birth. Chapter 88, Lord Shiva Saved from Vrikasura. King Parikshit said, "Those demigods, demons, and humans who worship Lord Shiva, a strict renunciant, usually enjoy wealth and sense gratification, while the worshippers of the Supreme Lord Hari, the husband of the goddess of fortune, do not. We wish to properly understand this matter, which greatly puzzles us. Indeed, the results attained by the worshippers of these two lords of opposite characters are contrary to what one would expect." Sri Shukadev Goswami said, "Lord Shiva is always united with his personal energy, the material nature. Manifesting himself in three features in response to the entreaties of nature's three modes, he thus embodies the threefold principle of material ego in goodness, passion, and ignorance. The 16 elements have evolved as transformations of that false ego. When a devotee of Lord Shiva worships his manifestation in any one of these elements, the devotee obtains all sorts of corresponding enjoyable opulences. Lord Hari, however, has no connection with the material modes. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the all-seeing eternal witness who is transcendental to material nature. One who worships him becomes similarly free from the material modes. Your grandfather, King Yudhisthir, after completing his Ashwamedha sacrifices, asked Lord Achyuta this very same question while hearing the Lord's explanation of religious principles. This question pleased Sri Krishna, the king's lord and master, who had descended into the family of Yadu for the purpose of bestowing the highest good on all men. The Lord replied as follows as the king eagerly listened." The personality of Godhead said, "If I especially favor someone, I gradually deprive him of his wealth. Then the relatives and friends of such a poverty-stricken man abandon him. In this way, he suffers one distress after another. When he becomes frustrated in his attempts to make money and instead befriends my devotees, I bestow my special mercy upon him. A person who has thus become sober fully realizes the Absolute as the highest truth, the most subtle and perfect manifestation of spirit, the transcendental existence without end. In this way, realizing that the Supreme Truth is the foundation of his own existence, he becomes freed from the cycle of material life. Because I am difficult to worship, people generally avoid me and instead worship other deities, who are quickly satisfied. When people receive kingly opulences from these deities, they become arrogant, intoxicated with pride, and neglectful of their duties. They dare to offend even the demigods who have bestowed benedictions upon them." Shukadev Goswami said, "Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu, Lord Shiva, and others are able to curse or bless one. Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma are very quick to curse or bestow benedictions, but the infallible Supreme Lord is not." In this connection, an ancient historical account is related concerning how the Lord of Kailas Mountain was put into danger by offering a choice of benedictions to the demon Vrika. The demon named Vrika, a son of Shakunis, once met Narada on the road. The wicked fellow asked him which of the three chief gods could be pleased most quickly. Narada told him, "Worship Lord Shiva and you will soon achieve success. He quickly becomes pleased by seeing his worshipper's slightest good qualities, and quickly angered by seeing his slightest fault. He became pleased with ten-headed Ravana and also with Bana when they each chanted his glories like bards in a royal court. Lord Shiva then bestowed unprecedented power upon each of them, but in both cases he was consequently beset with great difficulty. Thus advised, the demon proceeded to worship Lord Shiva at Kedaranath by taking pieces of flesh from his own body and offering them as oblations into the sacred fire, which is Lord Shiva's mouth. Vrikasura became frustrated after failing to obtain a vision of the Lord. Finally, on the seventh day, after dipping his hair into the holy waters at Kedaranath and leaving it wet, he took up a hatchet and prepared to cut off his head. But at that very moment, the supremely merciful Lord Shiva rose up out of the sacrificial fire, looking like the god of fire himself, and grabbed both arms of the demon to stop him from killing himself, just as we would do. By Lord Shiva's touch, Trikasura once again became whole. Lord Shiva said to him, "My friend, please stop, stop. Ask for me whatever you want, and I will bestow that boon upon you. Alas, you have subjected your body to great torment for no reason, since I am pleased with a simple offering of water from those who approach me for shelter." Shukadeva Goswami said, "The benediction sinful Vrika chose from the Lord would terrify all living beings." Vrika said, "May death come to whomever I touch upon the head with my hand." Upon hearing this, Lord Rudra seemed somewhat disturbed. Nonetheless, he vibrated Om to signify his assent, granting Vrika the benediction with an ironic smile, as if giving milk to a poisonous snake. To test Lord Shiva's benediction, the demon then tried to put his hand on the Lord's head. Thus Shiva was frightened because of what he himself had done. As the demon pursued him, Lord Shiva fled swiftly from his abode in the north, shaking with terror. He ran as far as the limits of the earth, the sky, and the corners of the universe. The great demigods could only remain silent, not knowing how to counteract the benediction. Then Lord Shiva reached the luminous realm of Vaikuntha, beyond all darkness, where the Supreme Lord Narayan is manifest. That realm is the destination of renunciants who have attained peace and given up all violence against other creatures. Going there, one never returns. The Supreme Lord, who relieves his devotees' distress, had seen from afar that Lord Shiva was in danger. Thus, by his mystic Yogamaya potency, he assumed the form of a brahmachari student with the appropriate belt, deerskin, rod, and prayer beads, and came before Vrikasura. The Lord's effulgence glowed brilliantly like fire. Holding kusha grass in his hand, he humbly greeted the demon. The Supreme Lord said, "My dear son of Shakuni, you appear tired. Why have you come such a great distance? Please rest for a minute. After all, it is one's body that fulfills all one's desires. Almighty One, please tell us what you intend to do, if we are qualified to hear it. Usually, one accomplishes his purposes by taking help from others." Shukadeva Goswami said, "Thus questioned by the personality of Godhead in language that poured down upon him like sweet nectar, Vrika felt relieved of his fatigue. He described to the Lord everything he had done." The Supreme Lord said, "If this is the case, we cannot believe what Shiva says. Shiva is the same lord of the pretas and pishatas whom Daksha cursed to become like a carnivorous hobgoblin. O best of the demons, if you have any faith in him because he is the spiritual master of the universe, then without delay put your hand on your head and see what happens. If the words of Lord Shiva prove untrue in any way, O best of the demons, then kill the liar so he may never lie again." Thus bewildered by the personality of Godhead's enchanting, artful words, foolish Vrika, without realizing what he was doing, placed his hand on his head. Instantly, his head shattered as if struck by a lightning bolt, and the demon fell down dead. From the sky were heard cries of "Victory, obeisances, and well done!" The celestial sages, Pitas, and Gandharvas rained down flowers to celebrate the killing of sinful Vrikasura. Now Lord Shiva was out of danger. The Supreme Personality of Godhead then addressed Lord Shiva. "Just see, O Mahadev, my lord, how this wicked man has been killed by his own sinful reactions. Indeed, what living being can hope for good fortune if he offends exalted saints? What to speak of offending the Lord and spiritual master of the universe? Lord Hari is the direct manifest absolute truth, the supreme soul and unlimited ocean of inconceivable energies. Anyone who recites or hears this pastime of his saving Lord Shiva will be freed from all enemies and the repetition of birth and death." Chapter 89, Krishna and Arjuna Retrieve a Brahman's Sons. Shukadeva Goswami said, "Once, O king, as a group of sages were performing a Vedic sacrifice on the banks of the Saraswati River, a controversy arose among them as to which of the three chief deities is supreme. Eager to resolve this question, the sages sent Lord Brahma's son Bhrigu to find the answer. First, he went to his father's court. To test how well Lord Brahma was situated in the mode of goodness, Bhrigu failed to bow down to him or glorify him with prayers. The Lord became angry at him, inflamed into fury by his own passion. Though anger toward his son was now rising within his heart, Lord Brahma was able to subdue it by applying his intelligence. in the same way that fire is extinguished by its own product, water. Bhrigu then went to Mount Kailas. There, Lord Shiva stood up and happily came forward to embrace his brother. But Bhrigu refused his embrace, telling him, "You are a deviant heretic." At this, Lord Shiva became angry, and his eyes burned ferociously. He raised his trident and was about to kill Bhrigu when Goddess Devi fell at his feet and spoke some words to pacify him. Bhrigu then left that place and went to Vaikuntha, where Lord Janardhan resides. There he went up to the Supreme Lord, who was lying with his head on the lap of his consort, Shri, and kicked him on the chest. The Lord then rose, along with Goddess Lakshmi, as a sign of respect. Coming down from his bedstead, that supreme goal of all pure devotees bowed his head to the floor before the sage and told him, "Welcome, Brahman. Please sit in this chair and rest a while. Kindly forgive us, dear master, for not noticing your arrival. Please purify me, my realm, and the realms of the universal rulers devoted to me by giving us the water that has washed your feet. This holy water is indeed what makes all places of pilgrimage sacred. Today, my lord, I have become the exclusive shelter of the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi. She will consent to reside on my chest because your foot has rid it of sins." Shukadeva Goswami said, "Bhrigu felt satisfied and delighted to hear the solemn words spoken by Lord Vishnu. Overwhelmed with devotional ecstasy, he remained silent, his eyes brimming with tears. Bhrigu then returned to the sacrificial arena of the wise Vedic authorities and described his entire experience to them. Amazed upon hearing Bhrigu's account, the sages were freed from all doubts and became convinced that Vishnu is the greatest Lord. From him come peace, fearlessness, the essential principles of religion, detachment with knowledge, the eightfold powers of mystic yoga, and his glorification, which cleanses the mind of all impurities. He is known as the supreme destination for those who are peaceful and equipoised, the selfless wise saints who have given up all violence. His most dear form is that of pure goodness, and the Brahmins are his worshipable deities. Persons of keen intellect who have attained spiritual peace worship him without selfish motives." The Lord expands into three kinds of manifest beings: the Rakshasas, the demons, and the demigods, all of whom are created by the Lord's material energy and conditioned by her modes. But among these three modes, it is the mode of goodness which is the means of attaining life's final success. Shukadeva Goswami said, "The learned Brahmins living among the river Saraswati came to this conclusion in order to dispel the doubts of all people. Thereafter, they rendered devotional service to the Supreme Lord's lotus feet and attained his abode." Sri Suta Goswami said, "Thus did this fragrant nectar flow from the lotus mouth of Shukadeva Goswami, the son of the sage Vyasadeva. This wonderful glorification of the Supreme Person destroys all fear of material existence. A traveler who constantly drinks this nectar through his ear holes will forget the fatigue brought on by wandering along the paths of worldly life." Shukadeva Goswami said, "Once in Dwaraka, a Brahmin's wife gave birth to a son, but the newborn infant died as soon as he touched the ground, O Bharata. The Brahmin took the corpse and placed it at the door of King Ugrasen's court. Then, agitated and lamenting miserably, he spoke the following, 'This duplicitous, greedy enemy of the Brahmins, this unqualified ruler addicted to sense pleasure, has caused my son's death by some discrepancies in the execution of his duties. Citizens serving such a wicked king, who takes pleasure in violence and cannot control his senses, are doomed to suffer poverty and constant misery.'" The wise Brahmin suffered the same tragedy with his second and third child. Each time, he left the body of his dead son at the king's door and sang the same song of lamentation. When the ninth child died, Arjuna, who was near Lord Keshava, happened to overhear the Brahmin lamenting. Thus Arjuna addressed the Brahmin, "What is the matter, my dear Brahmin? Isn't there some lowly member of the royal order here who can at least stand before your house with a bow in his hand? These Kshatriyas are behaving as if they were Brahmins idly engaged in fire sacrifices. The rulers of a kingdom in which Brahmins lament over lost wealth, wives, and children are merely impostors playing the role of kings just to earn their livelihood. My lord, I will protect the progeny of you and your wife, who are in such distress. And if I fail to keep this promise, I will enter fire to atone for my sin."